Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey guys, welcome back to The Female Gaze. I'm Jessie Katz.
I'm Alana Rodriguez.
I just faked the excitement in my voice because I have to say at the top of this episode that it's been a very hard week for me.
Why?
I lost the love of my life yesterday. Coy Luther Perry III, otherwise known as Luke Perry. There was one person my entire childhood and adolescence who I had 20 posters of on my bedroom wall at any given time, and that was Luke Perry. So this was very rough. I was very much in love with him my whole childhood, then realized when I got a little bit older that I think I really just wanted to be him, but whatever was going on there, he was very important to me, and so I'm very sad. I'll be going to Nighthawk Cinema in Brooklyn this weekend to watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the movie that he co-starred in with Christy Swanson. If you guys haven't seen it, highly recommend. And that's all that I can say about him, but just needed to shout that out at the top of the episode. I'm smiling through the tears.
The pain. You're in a mourning period.
I am.
Good thing we have a good show, though, today.
We do. And I will say, before we introduce our guests, on a lighter note, today is also the 20th anniversary of the release of Cruel Intentions. I just saw that in my timeline. So, Alana, before we kick it to our guests and introduce them, just wondering if you have fond memories of that film or what emotions that elicits.
Lesbianism?
Is your memory of that movie?
Memory? My memory, my two fondest memories are obviously the kiss and the cocaine in the necklace that I hope to have on my wedding day someday. Those are my two fondest memories. I obviously am a huge fan of Cruel Intentions. Obviously really enjoyed the dykiness of the film.
Can you be a little more, can you describe the kiss for those who might not remember?
Can you describe the kiss for those who might not remember?
It was Sarah Michelle Gellar and Selma Blair.
Selma Blair.
Filmmakers Erica Rose and Chelsea Moore, thank you for joining The Female Gaze.
Yeah, I would have to say my favorite moment, I know you didn't ask this, but my favorite moment of Cruel Intentions, because it just popped in my head, was when Sarah Michelle Gellar rubs her ass on Ryan Phillippe. Gave me a lot of ideas and inspiration for the rest of my life. So
I like that.
That was amazing. A really important scene.
And out of the
me.
Box. Yeah,
that's one of your top moves.
Yeah. Or just, you know, top fantasies. Yeah. Just being Ryan Phillippe's penis. I would love to be, you know. Yeah.
On a chaise lounge.
Yes.
Yeah. They're just talking about money and sexual attraction, and they're step siblings too.
Yes,
they are.
It's so kinky. It's great. Anyway,
okay, Erica and Chelsea, we invited you on the show because you run a production company that is very much aligned with things that we are very interested in. So I wanted to talk to you about your work and about the gaze that you guys are utilizing in your work. Your company is called Sour Peach Films. You have a new short film that is floating around the circuits that we got to preview and was amazing. So very excited to have you on the show and to dig into all of that. This podcast was inspired by largely the speech that Jill Soloway gave at the Toronto Film Festival several years ago. And one of the things that she said was the female gaze is the other gaze. It's like a bunch of gazes that are basically anything but the cis male straight gaze. So I think you check off some of those boxes and you try to, you know, you're kind of covering a femme queer gaze, but also I think you're seeking to tell in general stories that are a bit otherwise marginalized, overlooked. So, okay, we'll get into all of that in just a moment. But first,
my favorite.
Let's do a round of Float Your Boat.
Toot toot.
and be in your bonnet.
Buzz, buzz, bitch.
Oh, you came in hot on that one.
I feel like you liked that one a little bit.
I did. All right, Alana.
Yeah.
Will you kick us off with your boat of the week?
I actually have two boats this week. I rarely have more than one. They're both, they both happen to be things that I watched recently. So I'll make it super quick. The first one is I was also at Nighthawk, or I went to Nighthawk on Sunday, and I saw Greta. Not sure if you guys have seen Greta yet.
I saw it.
Yeah, it was a great film. I really liked it because afterwards I found myself thinking, like, obviously it was a really good movie in my opinion, but that I only remembered one male cast member, that everyone that was super striking, that had like a really important role, they were all women. So I was actually curious to know like what the percentage was, you know, when we did that percentage game last episode.
of female characters speaking on screen versus male. Yeah.
Exactly.
So Stephen Ray was in it briefly as the investigator.
Yeah.
Who I think, because Neil Jordan is the director who did The Crying Game. So that was like a cute little throwback.
Yeah.
And then Chloe Grace Moretz's father is in it a little bit.
Yeah.
Did you think it was a good movie, like just straight up a good movie? Or do you think it was a good B movie?
I think it was a good B movie.
Okay.
And
that's an important qualification.
I think I liked it a lot more because I appreciated the fact that, and this is a spoiler alert, so.
Spoiler alert.
Oh. Spoiler alert.
Well, I don't know if.
But.
Okay.
so you would expect for the investigator to figure out what was happening. Right. But there's a plot twist at the end where it wasn't the guy who you would expect to solve the case.
Uh-huh.
It was a female.
OK.
So I just liked that, you know, there was a woman that saved the day.
Yes.
But it was like the biggest. Wait, am I allowed to talk here?
I didn't know if I should ruin it. So I was trying to be very.
It's fine. I ruin movies for her.
OK. So
it was like the biggest plot hole. For me, though,
yes.
That they were like, let's hire a private investigator to find our missing daughter instead of, because let's be honest, if a pretty white girl in Manhattan went missing, the entire like state would be after her.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So if the dad was like, you know what, just like I'll pay anything I can for a private investigator.
Yeah.
It's like that to me was like you could have had everything else.
Yeah.
Still had like a full police investigation.
But I don't know if it's fair to call out plot holes in a movie like that.
Well, so I was really excited to see it because it reminded me of the B movie single white female genre,
yes.
A female obsession,
yes.
That I've been obsessed with a female obsession since I was a kid, you know, and it was like kind of speaking of like early femme eroticism, that's all we had, you know,
right.
Like Cruel Intentions, like doesn't really qualify, but like in terms of single white female or heavenly creatures,
yep.
Like we had, there was like an intense connection and eroticism between this like kind of really into crazy female friendship. Maybe crazy is not the right word to use, but like
obsessive.
This heightened female friendship.
Well, in these cases, I think crazy.
Yeah.
Is, if we're ever going to use that word.
Crazy, yeah.
But so I was really excited to see Greta because it was like, you know, kind of influenced by that. But I think I was really disappointed with just the execution. I think they could have gone further. Like I really wanted them to totally embrace the B movie aspect.
Yeah.
And instead it was just, I wasn't sure what point it was trying to make.
Yeah. I see what you're saying.
First of all, sorry, for those who don't know what the fuck we're talking about.
It's
a movie that just came out. Chloe Grace Moretz is a young woman living and working in New York City, and she finds a purse on the subway one day, and there's an ID inside it. So she goes to return it to its owner, who is a woman played by Isabelle Huppert, and they become friends very quickly because... the woman has an estranged daughter and is very lonely, and the young woman just lost her mother the year before and is clearly longing for a maternal relationship. And then this relationship quickly, it takes a turn into obsession and stalking and worse.
Yeah.
So, Erica, I'm interested to know what you think about something that I pulled out from an article Richard Brody just wrote about the movie yesterday, because I generally really respect him, but he said this about the movie that actually bugs me. Sorry, by the way, I totally did my homework on your boat, but
I didn't even know you knew that was my boat, so I'm actually really happy.
Yeah.
Okay.
I figured.
Yeah.
Okay. So he faulted the movie for having, quote, no psychosexual resonance a la Alfred Hitchcock or Chantal Ackerman, no textured sensuality a la Claire Denis or Paul Thomas Anderson. As if it had to have.
I was literally just
going to
say, did it need sexual chemistry between them? Was that necessary?
I don't think it. You know, I know what he was criticizing. I think that there was just no nuance to their relationship. And I 100% agree with you. It doesn't have to be sexual. And I think what he is, he's misattributing it, because instead he's making it, you know, it has to be this like sexual narrative. Whereas it could have just been, you know, it's like they are starting the movie at extremes. Isabelle Huppert doesn't have her daughter, and Chloe Grace Moretz is reeling after her mother's death. So that's a setup for something really explosive. And yet they get too caught up with the kind of logistical, kind of scary. They didn't know what they were trying to be. It was like she was trying to pop out scary rather than like a psycho, kind of not erotic, but like a, you know, just like a psychological thriller.
Yeah. There were definitely moments where I expected Isabelle to go harder. And she didn't.
But I think maybe I'm giving the filmmaker more credit than he deserves for being in on the joke. I felt like when that happened, it was intentional. And when I laughed out loud in those moments, I was supposed to laugh out loud. But maybe I was laughing out loud because it was unintentionally absurd. I don't know.
Well, I also think that Isabelle Huppert is the best living actor, in my opinion.
She crushed.
And and it's like, if you guys have seen Elle, that is one of my favorite movies of the past like 5 years. So you're dealing with someone who understands nuance, who can just stare at you and be incredibly menacing and vulnerable at the same time. So I felt like he wasn't looking at the talent he had in front of him and then was trying to use, like, you know, shot placement and music to kind of carry the emotional tonality of the film. Whereas you had incredible talent and you didn't need to do that. So that's where it's like it lacked any nuance. And so I think Richard Brody is speaking to that, but he's kind of making it about, of course, sex, which it doesn't have to be.
Right, exactly.
Okay. That movie was also my boat this week because I dug it. I had a couple of drinks while I watched it at the Draft House, and I think that also helped my enjoyment, and it was a good time. So I'm with you on that. So we're sharing a boat this week.
Okay, cool. I have a second one. I'm going to make it so quick. We don't need to talk because this one we did talk about. But if you guys haven't seen Pen 15 on Hulu.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, my God. You're going to love it, Jesse, because it's two comedians. It's very... you know, similar to like Alana and Abby. It's like the two power women that are comedians. But really, what the show is about is them in the seventh grade. So they're 13
grown
year
ups
olds.
Playing.
They're grown ups playing children. Yeah, but it's very believable that they're 13.
But also not, which is a plus about the show, because it makes it an extra level of like absurdity and goofiness and awkwardness. It's an awkwardness.
Like you're supposed to understand that that's a joke.
Yeah,
right?
For sure.
Yes.
For
that
sure.
There's like older playing
a nice like little disclaimer at the end of the show, which is like my favorite part when the credits are rolling. It's like adult actors are used for like no child actors are used for any of the sexual content.
That's awesome.
It is. I think that is maybe my favorite part.
It's amazing.
Is everyone around them 13?
Yes, and that's what's so perfect. The guys that they have crushes on, like everything. Are actually that age.
That's great.
You have to watch it. It's really funny. So those are my boats.
Thank you.
There's a whole episode, I think it's episode 3, entitled AIM, I think is the title. Oh. And it's just half an hour about AOL Instant Messenger.
Amazing. It's so good.
I was crying. It was so good.
Yeah,
that was great.
That was my life at 13.
Yeah. The whole soundtrack is like back in the 90s. All the posters, it's like Josh Hartnett. Like you'll, it's amazing.
Their wardrobe, it's a lot of like cargo. It's really good.
Okay,
really
I'll watch it tonight.
It's like children's plays. Delilah,
Claire's.
Wow, were they talking about Luke Perry?
No, okay. Sorry,
it's Josh. Josh Hartnett. What boats you guys got this week?
My boat, I was thinking about on the way here, I just fostered a puppy, I am fostering a puppy, so that's my...
Congrats, Mom!
Yeah, that's my my float for this week.
Okay.
I wish this is not an audio or a visual element here, but...
do you want to describe your dog?
It's a 10-week-old Chihuahua Terrier mix.
Oh,
He's like a little sandy brown with like little specks of black throughout.
What's his name?
They named him Rafiki.
but we were, which is fine. Yeah. He's like a little, teddy bear kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he's like super curious and playful, and just like we've already had our friends booking appointments to come over and hang out with said puppy.
And might you keep him or street foster?
We put in an adoption application this morning. Wow. So we'll see how that works out. But yeah, that's definitely. We were also watching. I watched The Kids Are All Right this past weekend because I was doing another podcast discussing that movie. And we came up with the idea that the puppy's name would be Mark Ruffalo.
Oh my God.
And then we went on and it became Bark Ruffalo.
Wow.
Done.
Yeah.
You have to
it's
now.
Like, it's so genius and obvious. How come we haven't all done that?
I know. It's like, this is a name that everyone's dog should have.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I told Chelsea that she's not allowed to get rid of Bark Ruffalo because he's now my therapy dog.
Oh, there you go.
Even though I have not met him, I'm emotionally like that.
You're
one.
You're attached now. Okay.
That's a great one.
I love that.
All right. Erica, what's your boat?
I'm going to go for a darker subject material.
Great. Yes, please.
I just spent the past two nights watching Leaving Neverland.
Me too.
So I am. I don't think I've ever been that impacted watching something before.
Me too.
I think what was so disturbing about it was that it really speaks to what celebrity is and how potent and powerful and seductive and dangerous it is. And
can you just tell people what this film is?
So, Leaving Neverland is a documentary, two-part documentary series, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's really about two victims of Michael Jackson, two men, and they were sexually molested by him when they were boys. And these were two people who defended him in the 90s, mm-hmm. and have since come out and said that they were also victims.
This is on HBO?
It's on HBO, yeah. And I think it was at Sundance this year, and then HBO acquired it. But I think what's so traumatizing about it is listening to it. I was like thinking about it, and I was like, they go into graphic detail about what happened.
Oh, yeah.
And I was thinking, I was like, why did they decide to include that? And I think it's because it had to demystify what actually happened, because I think so mm-hmm. much of the conversations around what Michael Jackson did to, and also I'm just for the listeners, trigger warnings, like, you know, but it's listening to, because we've been talking about it kind of theoretically, it's like always in this kind of mythology, it's like Michael Jackson would like sleep with little boys in beds, but mm-hmm. no one ever actually explained what he did. Mm-hmm. So the minute you hear these men talk about their sexual relationship, and you think about these lewd sex acts that only consenting adults should do with each other, mm-hmm. and then you think about what a 7-year-old looks like and sounds like, and the size of a 7-year-old, and that a grown man's penis is inside of a 7-year-old's mouth.
Yep.
Like, it is traumatizing to just mm-hmm. even think about that. Yeah. So I supported that they talked about it. I don't know how you guys felt
about
it.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Many a time my mouth I found was on the ground mm-hmm. just because I was in such shock that the details were so graphic. Mm-hmm. I think it's so important that they did speak up about this, because not only does it give you this really important look on what you said, celebrity, but also just like child abuse in general, how these mm-hmm. children perceived their abuser. You know, it was never someone that was hurting them.
Right.
They felt that was love. That was their first sexual contact with anyone. And then it was Michael Jackson, you know, Wade Robson, an incredibly famous Australian choreographer who a lot of his career is attributed to Michael, and what, you know, he was fixated with Michael as a kid.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden this man is telling you he loves you and saying this is what love means.
Right.
And you not being able to process or understand, but going with it and then defending him, like you said, in the trials. So I think that it's so important for people to watch and understand mm-hmm. that this shit happens, period.
Yeah, and that it's confusing.
Very confusing.
I think that the mothers play a really interesting role. And there was an article that Slate published where it was talking about how, especially in the second part, the filmmakers take like a very critical stance on the mothers. And they are absolutely to blame. Like, if you think about it, what mother lets a 7-year-old child sleep in the bed of a man.
Yeah.
But I think we have to remember the conversation around molestation and sexual abuse back in the 80s and early 90s was almost non-existent. Mm-hmm. This was before the Boston Priest scandal. This is before Me Too. This mm-hmm. is before it was really in our consciousness, and it's still the conversations around sexual abuse is not enough.
Yeah.
So I think for these mothers, it was purely unfathomable that something like this would happen. Even with there is allegations, accusations, it was like, you know, they were enchanted and seduced by the message that Michael was projecting.
Yeah.
Which was childhood bliss, like literally Neverland. Yeah. So, you know, it's really the mothers to me were like, it was the most painful thing because, you know, how they like missed it. They kept missing
it. Multiple times.
Yeah. For years.
Yeah.
You know, they would be in the other room.
Right.
While this was going on.
So I have a pessimistic theory that this movie is not actually going to have a huge impact on how we look at his legacy, because I think that we have always known that this shit probably happened and it always got settled out of court and whatever. But like ever since I was old enough to know anything, I've known that that was probably true about him, and we didn't have any of these details. But I feel like as a culture, we already decided that it's fine. We love his music so much that we are okay with it. And I don't know if this will move the needle on that. I'm very curious to see, though.
Yeah, I'm curious to see, too. I mean, I agree with you. Like, I just remember growing up with the idea and the knowledge that he did this. Yeah. I remember it being in, like, my vocabulary. Mm-hmm. But then
Macaulay Culkin would come out and be like, no, I swear, we were just friends. It was totally innocent. He was a child, too. And we're like, well, Macaulay Culkin said it was fine, so.
Right. And then they show footage from his funeral of, like, and I remember watching his funeral. And I remember, like, mm-hmm. and sometimes I still listen to his music.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then this was a reminder. It was like, I think that's why it had to be a graphic reminder.
Yeah. Agreed.
Because mm-hmm. it's like, wake up, people. Like, he's, you know, a rapist and a molester, or wasn't, you know, rapist and molester. So, yeah. Okay.
Good.
Yeah.
I mean, good boat.
Good boat.
I was like gonna go with like a lighter subject, but no, I was like, great. It's been on my mind.
Yeah. I was just watching the second part this morning. So
nice way to start your day.
Yeah, I know, right? Child molestation.
Okay. All right, Lana, what's your B?
What's my B? The fucking Bachelor is my B this week. The show. I love The Bachelor.
I still have never seen it.
I love watching hot girls cry. So that's why I watch The Bachelor specifically, and obviously The Bachelorette. So I think it's, you know, just at the end of a long day, you just want to sit down and watch some like trashy TV. You know what I mean? So The Bachelor does that for me on a Monday night. What's bothering me and what has bothered me and what reminded me that I was bothered when I was watching last night is the lack of diversity of women. It's all white girls. There's like three black girls, maybe an Asian here.
Out
and
of
there.
How many?
Maybe, I don't know how
I
many.
I think he started with 30?
Yeah.
Oh.
And then they eliminate a lot the first night.
Yes.
Okay.
But exactly. It's like half get eliminated the first night. But yeah, he starts out with somewhere around 30.
Exactly.
And you can tell, like, I've never watched The Bachelor until this season, and I'm watching because my my partner and my roommate watch it.
Yeah.
And they love it, and I think my roommate loves it because of the same reason. It's just like, oh, she's really pretty.
Yeah. And now she's sad.
And now she's sad. Yeah. But she's still pretty.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you can see his specifically, I mean, I don't have a back history catalog in my memory of like the habits of bachelors, but you can see who the producer is saying you have to keep.
Yes.
And then who he is actually connecting with. And it's always like the no drama, no personal history, very simple, dumb, happy white girl.
White girl.
Like tiny little white girl. He just wants, who's not quite his mommy, not quite like too much, but like lets him get away with everything and is like, I love you.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm falling for you.
Yeah, and unfortunately, and maybe this isn't true, but it appears to me as a watch a viewer that often the women of color who move and progress to later rounds are ones that I think the producers have asked them to keep around, because sometimes it's very obvious when there's no physical connection, but then he'll give her a rose and you literally in your head say, well, it's because she was Hispanic or it's because she was black and they need that color. Yeah. So that
we need to make it like not 100% obvious that he
he's only into white girls. White girls.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, he has to take someone else non-white home to his parents.
Exactly.
Or meet their parents.
Exactly.
And it's so obvious, the difference when he goes and has those interactions.
Oh my God, insane.
Has there ever been a black or person of color bachelor?
Rachel was the first black bachelorette. And that was like, she's black and this is the bachelorette. That was literally the whole dialogue around it. And I was like, how about she's another woman trying to find love? You know what I mean?
Right.
How about we just go with
so
that
earnest.
One? You know, it's just like everyone was all.
Has there been, ever been a black
no.
male bachelor? Interesting.
And there was also, I remember hearing conversations because my roommate and my apartment were watching it when Rachel was the bachelorette. There was such a conversation from viewers about who she was picking, the color of the person that she was picking to go on dates with.
Yes.
Way higher than what's happening with this
Colton.
Like white dude.
Yeah,
yeah, Colton.
I got
dude.
You. Don't worry.
I'm sorry.
Who looks like a thumb.
Wait, isn't that the name of help me, Josh Pfefferman's son in Transparent? Isn't his name Colton?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just figured out why I'm so
the
familiar.
The preacher.
Whole milk.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
White
that's
boy.
Him.
Right. Cornbread.
That is literally
same.
This year's
so
bachelor.
So you have to be like that if your name is Colton.
100%.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good. He loves
Thought
whole milk.
Established
your
that.
Parents yeah. are that.
Yeah.
To,
right.
To name you Colton. Yeah. To name their child Colton, they're definitely that.
Exactly. So yeah, bring diversity. Otherwise, I'm going to be mad again.
Well, like real diversity.
Real diversity.
Right. Like not, I mean, and it is kind of like, okay, well, this is reality, so it's like not, but.
I know.
It's all performative diversity or performative reality.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's like, it still falls flat.
Right.
It's just still disappointing.
Exactly. Very disappointing.
Could
Womp.
Be.
Thanks.
Your
turn.
Okay. My B this week is, I'm just going to say something really general, and it's actually kind of just what you said, Chelsea, but. This could be a whole nother episode, but I've just had this idea floating around in my head lately. Every time I look at Instagram and I see people posting really generic women's content now, like
such as
like a meme of AOC or like these old timey pictures of women with some kind of little feminist thing under it. And then it, like everyone likes it and then moves on with their lives. And I'm starting to get a little stressed out by it because I'm starting to feel like we're losing the meaning of everything that we've been building over the last few years. And like, I worry that movements get, they get too mainstream and they stop being radical. And when you lose the radical element of it, then you're not actually going to affect change because things need to be, they need to have radical edges. Because if you're just like being cute about it and posting memes and making t-shirts and stuff, that's not actually going to affect any change. And like I always throw this phrase around when people ask me why sometimes I'm like very extreme in my opinions about things. And I'm like, because revolution is a lion, not a lamb. Like you have to be fucking ferocious about some things in order for anything to happen. Mm-hmm. And so I get nervous. It reminds me of, and like, look, I think The Wing is a very positive place for a lot of reasons, and we had someone from The Wing on the show before, and I am still currently a member, but Alana and I went to an event at The Wing where they had Eileen Miles and Jill Soloway and Hannah Gadsby and Masha Gessen. Mm-hmm. So you have like four of the premier queer feminist thinkers who are alive on this planet right now in one room, and the conversation was so pointless, meandering, like... we came away with nothing. And it's like, how do you squander that opportunity? Meanwhile, The Wing will organize like a Q&A with J-Lo where the line is like around the fucking block and they promote it every second of every day. And like that's very much their brand. And I feel like people join a place like The Wing and follow them on social media and feel like they're doing their job and checking off the box.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's nothing.
Yeah. It's funny because I've been having a lot of meetings out of The Wing just this year. And I'm not a member. I just exploit the resources for free. So that's the only way I'll ever like be at The Wing. And it's funny because I remember I'm working with this director there and we were like setting up interviews for a potential crew member. And I was like, okay. And then like this guy will meet you at this time. She's like, oh, wait. There's a really arduous approval process to bring in a cis man. And like, let's avoid that. And I was thinking to myself, like, I understand spaces that are exempt from men. Like, I really want to curate my life that way. I totally get
Absolutely.
That.
Same.
Yeah, but I think it just gets really dicey when it's just you use really general language because it doesn't allow for what the queer community has, some of the queer community has already acknowledged, that there's a lot of nuance and it's complicated sometimes. Yeah. You know, it's like,
yeah,
I don't know what their policy is for non-binary people or trans people. Mm-hmm. And I actually think they should go off the model of the sex party submit. I'm just going to go there. There's, I don't know if you guys have heard of it.
No, tell me.
There's a sex party called Submit. And it's like once a month. It happens at the basement of this Park Slope Associated Supermarket.
Cool.
It's this whole dungeon down there. And it's a sex party that excludes cis men. But otherwise, everyone else is included. So you could be a trans man, a non-binary person, a cis woman, a trans woman. And you just can't be a cis dude. And honestly, it's an honor system, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's like, if you come to the door, they're not going to be like, what's your gender identity?
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, yeah, that's
they're not checking you.
That's my question with the wing is like, how do you, at the front desk, show that you are a cis man or not?
Exactly.
Because your ID may not match your.
Yeah.
Exactly. It just gets
actual identification.
So it should just be like, hey, like, cis men, you're not, like, invited. And it should be an honor system.
Yeah. I mean, also, I've brought a lot of queer women to the wing who automatically feel uncomfortable when they walk in there because the aesthetic is the kind of place when you're growing up a woman in the world where you are, you know that you're going to feel uncomfortable. You know that you're going to feel different from a lot of the other women that are there. This like pastel pink kind of bullshit. And it's like, how come they aren't aware of that? Yeah. It really makes me crazy.
Yeah.
So then it's like, so what are you aside from just a place where women, however you're defining that, can go hang out? That's not enough to me.
Yeah.
That's not like a vision for this world.
Yeah.
Right.
It seems it falls very flat for me. And even going back to what you were saying with the panel that we went to with Jill and Hannah, it was so disappointing. The moderator posed a question to the audience and she said, you know, ask any of these women anything for them to discuss, right? And you're like, wow, we're going to get some incredible questions, super thoughtful. The first thing that comes out of someone's mouth is, what is your opinion on dildos? And literally, Jesse and I looked at each other and we were like, you're really
good. So thank you. This is really my point, because the wing, good intentions, whatever. Like, I'm still glad that they exist.
Yeah,
but,
me too.
But people are going to the wing. And so you assume that because you're a member there or you are friends of members there, that you are into something or part of something, or you're invested in some kind of movement or progress in this country. And then when you go to an event like that and you see that the people in the audience don't really get what's happening with these amazing thinkers that are in the room, it's like, I don't know. Yeah. I think we're still missing the mark.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my B.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to like the women's march. You know, it's like, okay, I showed up to the march and like that's my, I'm now this.
Exactly.
This is my activism. Yep. And I don't think the women's march is radical activism.
No.
Right.
No. I think it's exclusionary. It excludes other able-bodied bodies.
Yeah.
It's not accessible.
Mm-hmm.
It's classist. Mm-hmm. It's, you know.
Yeah. People go to take their photo for Instagram.
Take your photo.
And leave.
Yeah, and it's very, like, white ladies taking over something that we have not been the forefront of, but we get to be on the poster for.
Right. I mean, look, not everyone is built to be a radical. I'm not even asking that. I just want the radicals to keep being radicals. I hope that they don't get discouraged when this stuff becomes very bland and monopolized by corporations and social media and, you know.
Yeah. I will continue to take the wing's free tampons, though.
Yeah.
Every time I have a meeting there, it was so great. I had the first day of my period. I was like, this sucks. I don't have anything. Yeah. I go to the bathroom and there's like, and I was like, you know what? I'm very critical of it, but I will take your free tampons. Yes.
Lola brand is life.
Yeah. Oh, it felt so good.
I know. Yeah. I'm there with you. I'm always taking the free shit.
Yeah. Good memory.
Yeah.
All right, your bees?
Like a general frustration with kind of going off what you were saying of, I feel like I am falling into that rut of discouragement and just like pushing continuously. And that's part of the work, that's part of what we do. And that's also, other people do it a lot more than I do it. But trying to love like what the work that we're doing and with Sour Peach and with other people in our community. This is what I said the other day, is I'm exhausted of every space that I go into of feeling like I need to defend what it is I'm doing, or to explain what it is I'm doing, or to explain or defend my friends, my community, the other people's work that I talk about. And I'm feeling exhausted from defense, from defending, feeling like I've got to explain and defend.
Yeah. But what's the alternative, right?
Right, obviously.
That's the thing.
Yeah. It's like the burden that queer people have to carry.
Yeah.
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 Right.
It's just annoying.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's good B. We feel you.
Yeah.
All right, Erica.
I think my B is women apologizing for eating.
Yes,
like was thinking
always
about this.
And forever.
Oh my God.
I was on a date once and I remember it was like a really weird date. She and I are cool, but like I remember we
But not dating.
Okay. We didn't make it past date one. But I remember I was like, want to order some appetizers? And she was like, yeah. And then we ordered some like burrata and like a salad and like, you know, whatever. And then the food came and she took one bite and she goes, oh, I'm sorry, I'm just like stuffing my face. And I was like, hold up. One, you took one bite. Two, we're at dinner. Three, never apologize for eating again. And then I, after that, I was like, I just started to be hyper aware of the women or femme people in my life who were apologizing after every bite they took, pretty much. And, you know, it's like, it's like, girl, just like eat your burger. Like, who cares?
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm just so sick of women feeling bad about what they put into their bodies. It's like, you know, I just, you know.
Yeah.
I think we're trained. I don't know if you guys agree or not. We're trained to apologize for every calorie we consume.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I offer a flip side of that experience?
Please.
I recently went out a few times, and then we'll move on to your guys' shit. We've taken way too long in this segment, but it's been really interesting. But I went out a few times with this girl who never brought up the idea of eating. Like the first couple of times we would just have drinks. It was like, okay. And then we were going to meet at a time where like, I was going to be hungry. I was coming from work and I was like, are you going to want to eat? And she was like, no, I'll be good. And I was like, well, what does that mean? She's like, well, I will have eaten earlier because I have a class. So I eat before the class. So I don't get hungry during the class. Da, da, da. I was like, well, can't you like modulate what you eat before that class so that you can still be a little hungry later? And she was like, no, I can't do that. I was like, okay. So we didn't eat again. And then she told me a few days later she was going to dinner with people, and I was like, are you gonna eat dinner with them? Like, you're gonna order? And she was like, yeah. And I was like, okay, so you are capable of planning things so that you can have food at a certain time. You just aren't doing it when we hang out. And then I realized that I sounded obsessed with this, but it really was bothering me. It's like, if I can't eat with somebody, we can't date.
What was her reasoning?
She dodged the question. I don't know. I don't understand.
Maybe she was embarrassed about how she ate and it wasn't like sexy for her.
The last time we hung out, I ordered a 3-course meal and she only drank alcohol.
What?
Because I was like, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm going to order food for myself.
Good.
Wait, that is so weird.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, I mean, I've done it before where I've said I don't want to eat dinner because I want to get out faster just in case, but only if it's a first date.
Yeah,
you know
what
I mean? Like,
I
don't
want
to sit down to a dinner, and if I fucking hate you, then I have to eat the whole
meal. Yeah, dinner on a first date.
No.
Yeah,
that's a big commitment.
It's a no for me.
That's why I always, or I try to do oysters on a first date. I mean, not only is it my go-to move, but it's also one, I love oysters, and two, it's you can do it quickly.
Yeah,
it doesn't take that long to suck it. It's immediate because it's raw, and if.
A sound bite there.
So much
innuendo. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and you get to see the potential of their lip and
tongue
abilities. So it's perfect, and you get to show off yours. It's like, honestly, if
it's
you're
an interactive
date. If explore you're a queer femme and not sucking oysters with someone, you're doing it wrong.
100%.
Yeah.
Agreed. Agreed. That's probably my favorite bee.
Yeah, that's great.
Of life.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right. So let's get into Sour Peach.
Yes.
Transition straight into that. So I have a bunch of questions to ask you, but quickly first, can you give us a rundown of what you would describe as the mission statement of the company and the stuff that you guys were making?
So Sour Peach was founded, we've said this a couple times, out of just like our mutual frustration with the content that was available and what we were saying, you know, with like Cruel Intentions of like, this wasn't for us, yeah. It isn't for us, but it is now ours. We will take it. Because that's what's out there. Uh-huh. And we were both working. We met on an Ava DuVernay pilot a couple years ago and kind of bonded over queer frustration, queer femme frustration, and decided to make work that expressed and showed femme queer sexuality. Specifically, we've come down more and more to like this femme sexuality as being, you know, something that we keep our subject matter, our focus, because it seems radical the more and more I do it, of showing of as we go around with our short film Girl Talk, uh-huh. and people are just like very confused about where to place us and how to program us in a festival, mm. and people are like, have a lot of questions after seeing like, or like very surprised when it's like queer femmes on screen being sexual or intimate with each other and not involving anyone else.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Yeah. And the fact that it was made by queer femme people, those were like, I mean, obviously we are, and the primary crew members and department heads were mostly queer femme people or queer people or women, straight women, some straight women, I think one or two made it in there.
Diversity hires.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. 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 One or two straight men too.
Yeah, and being, yeah, being actively, not only in just like what we're depicting, the stories that we're telling, mm-hmm. but also in the way in which we're making it, who we're bringing on, yeah. who we're collaborating with, being able to bring on co-writers and co-producers who fit into these other places within the world of queer femness, mm-hmm. That we don't fit, mm-hmm. Or we don't express those particular narratives.
Right. Got it. So in that case, you'll produce it. But then for other stuff, you'll write and direct and produce it, correct?
Yeah. I mean, I think we, you know, there's some projects that we, like, you know, with Girl Talk, like, I wrote and directed and Chelsea produced it. And then there's some projects that we just come on as producers. Mm. Like, we did this short film for PBS that was directed by our friend Carlos Valdivia. And that was about a Latinx gay man. So, you know, we came on board to support that project and to produce it. Obviously, we are not
Latin gay men,
but, you know, it definitely kind of fit within our mission statement. Uh-huh. So we'll do stuff like that as well.
Right. So we've been trying to work our way through defining, if you can define, what certain kinds of gazes mean in terms of if you have someone of that identity writing and directing and mm-hmm. shooting and producing, how that translates aside from the subject matter itself. Mm-hmm. So aside from saying, well, it's a story about a queer woman, for example, how do you think we could see the effect of having queer women producers, writers, directors?
Well, it's all about authenticity.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I don't think there's steadfast rules necessarily. I think that a cis man could direct a scene with two women having sex with each other with like dignity and poignancy. Like, I think that the movie Carol, what Todd Haynes did with the scene between Rooney Mara and Cate Blanchett when they first have sex, is perfect for the story and for the characters. And it's contextually sound.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that in the majority of cases, when you take away the director is like the main creative force behind a film. And if you take away the main creative force that can tell the story with as most authenticity as possible, then you're creating a cognitive dissonance that someone will have to guess or, you know, fantasize mm-hmm. about what happens between like two women. So, and then you get something like Blue is the Warmest Color, right. which is, you know,
I've heard you talk about on another podcast.
Yeah.
And you very eloquently pinpointed the problem with the way that he directed that scene.
Yeah. Thank you.
Which had to do with what he did with the camera, basically.
Yeah. I mean, I think that what, for those who have not seen it, there's the first scene. So Adele is 15 in the movie, and she has sex with Lea Seydoux's character, who has blue hair, and she's much older, and not much older, but she's like a college student. And the majority of the film is shot in close-ups, and you're in Adele's mind. You're with her the entire time. And then when you get to the sex scene, you are – it's a wide shot. It's far away. It's on display. You're not in her head. And they're also having sex that's, like, pretty extreme. Mm. Not to say that women can't have sex that way. I think you are. It's totally physically possible, and many people can get off to it. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't fit within the context of the story because she's 15 and losing her lesbian virginity. I don't think she would be doing, like, reverse cowgirl grinding.
Yeah.
Like, maybe. Yeah. I mean, but I just think that's, like, unlikely.
Uh-huh.
So you lose – what you lose is her journey, and that's what feeds into the exploitation and the lack of authenticity.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just wonder if there's a way that we could define the queer female gaze. I mean, and this is maybe being a little gimmicky to try to define it this way, but I'm just thinking, like, what does that mean? Like, let's say Todd Haynes was studying a queer woman director and was able to apply something that he noticed that she was doing to when he shoots that scene in Carol. Because, like, I don't know. I feel like I've noticed in things that are created by queer women or had input by them that there's a little bit more attention to, like, things that are unspoken, to, like, very small gestures, to, like, very kind of casual touches that carry a lot of feeling for somebody. Yeah. I think those are the things that I think I associate them with queer women in general, being very attuned to that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that is often very much what is happening between two people before and while they're having sex also, right? And so when I see that in a sex scene, that feels like maybe something that is inherently queer and female to me.
Yeah.
Trying to work out a theory there.
I think the details is exactly right. I mean, a lot of people watch Girl Talk and they come up to us and they are struck by the attention to consent. And it's funny because, like, we've talked about this a lot. Yeah, like, when I wrote, like, the first draft of the script, it definitely didn't carry the same kind of consensual weight to it. It's not that it was unconsensual or non-consensual. It was it just didn't have the same kind of, like, details. But then with workshopping the script with Chelsea, you know, it became apparent that this was integral to the story.
Right.
And you know, there's, and it doesn't take away from the narrative. It actually adds to the narrative, and it's something that should be seen. And it's like people.
It makes it more intimate.
Yeah.
It adds a level of intimacy to it.
Mm-hmm. It adds level of intimacy and authenticity, like authenticity.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in, like, you know, this story is based on some of my sexual experiences and some of people from our communities, and, you know, that was all there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those kind of aspects of touch and permission and talking about it beforehand.
Yeah. I mean, I think I've heard Jill Soloway talk about how we don't usually see consent in movies and in sex scenes. That's something that's missing. And then I heard Maggie Gyllenhaal on a podcast or a radio show or something recently talking about when she made Secretary. And there was this scene in Secretary when her character, like, very subtly touched James Spader's wrist. And they kept doing different takes of the scene. And she noticed after a while, because they were getting coverage, she noticed that the camera actually wasn't catching that at all. It was off camera. And she got very concerned because to her, that very small gesture meant consent by her character to what they were doing. And, you know, this was her first big role and she didn't have the confidence to say anything. But at some point she actually told James Spader, and he went and told them, like, you guys need to catch this on camera. This gesture is very important to her. And then they did.
Yeah.
Alana.
Damn.
Yes.
I don't know. Part of me just now was like, it sucks that she had to go ask the dude to ask
for
her. But yeah, I understand when you're in a position where it's like your first big movie and you don't want to upset anyone. But
And it was like 2004.
Yeah.
You don't even know how to start that conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
Totally.
Yeah. Agreed, though. Attention to detail is what sets everything apart, because it's very hard for me to watch a sex scene that's clearly directed by someone who doesn't understand queer female sex feel disconnected immediately, because it's like you just don't get it, you know, from the tiniest little things like a hand or an eye contact or something. It changes the whole game. So it's really like, I don't know, whoever you're directing for, the audience that you're directing for. Like, for example, in the movie, I never saw the movie that you were talking about the Adele, the 15-year-old.
Blue is Warmest Blue Color?
I've never seen it.
What?
I know.
Is weirder than when you said you never heard Ani DeFranco's
Ani DeFranco. I know,
music.
I'm a terrible gay. but it's like, who was he directing for, right? Did he give a shit? It's not like he really needed to prove a point with that scene. It was just people you want to do. It's like porn.
Well, it's funny because thinking about that movie, it's like he was seeking validation from an audience that's outside of like queer femme people, because we're not seen as like the kind of markers of critical success.
Yeah.
So it didn't matter what we felt, because that movie won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. So it's like
it wasn't for us in the first place.
Yeah, exactly.
So he was shooting believability for a different audience.
Right.
Yeah.
For an audience that has no concept of what queer femme sexuality is or looks like or cares.
Right.
They just don't.
Yeah.
It wasn't.
And then to them, that's what it is after.
Right. It's a using, and this is what a lot of, this is, you know, the opposite of like female gaze is like using queer stories for other people's good feelings or viewership and like for awards. And you know, this is like a bee in my bonnet is like if I see another like straight person using queer stories for like queer stories of pain or suffering or discomfort for award bait or for any sort of like accolades, I'm just like, I'm ready to burst open.
It's been
one of the like most frustrating things going around, is like seeing all this wonderful art that's being put out into festivals by independent filmmakers, and then also at the same time seeing people who are slipping in and telling stories, and it's like, okay, this was about a mass club shooting, and we're gonna see another one. Or, you know, this is another painful coming out story. And it's the limitations. I think it's also the exciting part about when you're trying to describe and nail down what the female gaze is that we don't really have a lot of examples of it.
So
the exciting part to think about is as we hopefully push and fight to have more examples of that and to see more scenes of like female sexuality from that perspective, then it broadens, because we have more examples, we have more variety, because it's not a soft, it's not necessarily like people are like, oh, it's like soft and tender is like a female gaze. And it's like, but you look at like the bisexual and there's a lot of scenes in there, like sexual scenes where it's like boring or messy or dirty or just kind of sloppy or disconnected. You know, you can have all of those, that richness.
Yeah. It's so true that there's, in most art, it's from the male gaze, and, you know, film aside, like there's just not examples of it. So there is this kind of flexibility and this openness that, you know, and part of our work in Sour Peach is furthering queer narratives and kind of, you know, stripping it from this like false dichotomy of either a coming out story or, you know, a taboo relationship, because, or, you know, queer suffering, because so much of queer stories have kind of, you know, been in those places. And it's not to say that those aren't valid stories, but, you know,
they're not the only stories.
And I think that's part of our mission as a production company, is to really kind of open people's eyes to the, you know, nuance.
Diversify and normalize on main screen.
I think it's a system of control, is to support only those stories. It's a controlling of our narrative. It's a controlling of any sort of public expression of where we are and what our lives are on a daily basis. We're not allowed to have that. We're not allowed to live on screen in any other way. We're either like support of another person's growth. We're, you know, and this applies to lots of different other people's stories.
We were just talking about this from the trans perspective with Ashley last week too.
Trans characters always have to be tragic.
Or
their defining characteristic is their transness, and nothing else interesting about them.
100%
It's the same way that like a lot of the kind of films that have majority black characters are usually like, that have been like, oh, successful in the award season has mm-hmm. been, you know, either they're mm-hmm. slaves or, you know, being rescued by yeah. white men, like, yes. you know, to bring up Green Book, which I did not see out of principle. And yeah. I refuse to see it.
I haven't seen it, but I'll still shit talk it on my own podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's from like literally the stupidest perspective.
Yeah.
That is like the stupid gaze.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. Totally. Yeah. Exactly.
But, you know, it also becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you're only ever telling these really depressing stories about queer people, why would straight audiences want to see that? I mean, if it was only depressing stories about straight characters, I wouldn't go to see those either. I would be like, no, that's very niche and not for me, you know?
Yeah.
So then we say, like, well, straight audiences aren't interesting in seeing these stories. Like, well, because they're not told at like a real human level that is relatable to anybody.
And that's how queer people right. are taught to straight people.
Yeah.
That's how we learn about queer people. We learn about queer people through exactly. struggle, mm-hmm. through pain, through mm-hmm. suffering, through disenfranchisement. We are very rarely introduced to queer people in our lives that is in a positive light. Yeah, I want to give... I have like a couple examples of my life where I remember in fourth grade, it was like we had a student who had two moms and the teacher did something profound, which is she had a roundtable discussion and basically was like, Chris has two moms and it's totally okay. And his moms are like everyone else. And I remember being like, why are we like interrupting class to do this? But mm-hmm. then I was like, thank God we did this, because it was one of the few examples where queerness was introduced as mm-hmm. something normal yeah. and something we can talk about and ask questions about and in a classroom setting.
Yeah.
And it's so, that was such a privilege I had. And most of our introductions to queer people is through either the lens of HIV and AIDS or, you know, Matthew Shepard and hate crimes.
Right. Yeah. Yep. I'm wondering to myself, so I was thinking like the queer female gaze, like if you're directing a sex scene that way, that really just should be the female gaze in the sense that, like, if you're doing it real, then that should be, like, a realistic depiction, emotionally realistic, that anyone can relate to. And I'm wondering if, I'm not articulating this well, but I'm getting to this question.
I see it.
We're well, rooting for you.
Thank you. So, okay, for example, that sex scene in blue is the warmest color. I'm wondering if straight men would enjoy watching that scene more the way that it is now, or if a queer woman had directed it and if it was, you know, done correctly.
I think it depends on the straight man.
I was gonna say, I feel like it's straight
I'm
men
wondering
are so
if they
easy
also
to
would
like
respond
all.
Better to that being directed correctly.
Correctly in the sense
like
that
if it would benefit any audience member, male or female, gay or straight.
Yeah, I mean, I think more authentic stories. I mean, obviously, if like someone other than Peter Farrelly had directed Green Book, it probably all would have maybe, but
right.
could have benefited a lot of us to actually have been told this story.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you just telling things more authentically makes for hopefully like more enjoyable. I don't know. Yeah. Better and good is a hard like.
I just think there's more to connect to there. I mean, yeah. maybe a straight man will get off a little bit watching that sex scene, even if it's filmed as if it's a fucking GoPro in the corner, which it kind of was. But he's not emotionally connecting to it because the director isn't giving you a way to do that. Whereas yeah. there's another way to shoot it where even a straight dude can connect to it both physically and emotionally, yeah. therefore get more out of it.
Well,
how would, and maybe this is a dumb question, but how would a straight man... Why would a straight man want to emotionally connect with that type of scene?
Because it's just human beings.
Well, I think that your question speaks to the intentionality of this, what the intentionality of the scene should have been.
Mm.
So it's like you are in this story, within the narrative, this is the first time this is her first love. So they're showing a sex scene where someone is when there are two people who are so hungry for each other mm-hmm. and it's like their sexual tension is so palpable and they're falling in love. So what you should feel from the scene is not necessarily, yeah, like being turned on could be like a secondary kind of ramification of the scene. But mm-hmm. the intention should have been these are two people, you are watching our main character fall in love and be enraptured by this person. And if you, the main thing that I think what you're talking about is that what we're assuming is that most you know, a lot of straight men would watch this and be like turned on because it was shot pornographically. And then that speaks to the failure of the director.
Yeah.
Right.
Because the failure here is that the big takeaway from it is the descent of either it's like really hot and turns you on, or it's like unbelievable, or it's exploitative. And really, this should have been a moment where you feel her be enraptured and falling in love.
Right.
So I think it's like,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Ooh, cut through the weeds.
Yeah.
No. But, you know, a straight man should be able to emotionally connect to any movie or any scene that's supposed to be emotional.
Well, and
whether it's mother and daughter, or whatever.
Yeah. And actually, a lot of, you know, not that, and I always say this, not that I need the validation of straight men, because, like, fuck that.
Right.
But a lot of people, after they watch Girl Talk, have come up to both of us, and a lot of straight men have come up and been like, I really connected to this. Because at the end of the day, we're dealing with universal themes. We're dealing with universal themes of loneliness and isolation and the longing for intimacy. But we're telling it within a queer femme world. But it doesn't mean that other people can't relate to it.
Yeah.
And that's what's really powerful about and it really comes back to like just filmmaking techniques. It's like understanding what your movie's about and what every scene is about. And if you understand that as a director, then you can make anyone feel anything.
Right.
And you should be able to, like, anyone who doesn't know anything about your world should be able to connect to it.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Totally.
Yeah.
This is kind of an aside, but a friend of ours reposted something on Instagram yesterday that I thought was perfect. And it's just a little quote I want to share.
I didn't see it. Tell me.
Shaniqua posted it.
Yeah.
She said, if your vagina doesn't have a heartbeat when you see them, they ain't the one. And I thought it was so perfect, right?
Absolutely.
That's, yeah. So hell, I think that's something we should keep in mind when we're directing sex scenes.
Vagina heartbeats?
Yeah. Make those vaginas pitter patter. But it actually is a physical, it's a physical thing.
Yeah.
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 Anyway, if you don't know what we're talking about, ask someone with a vagina. Okay, so Girl Talk is a short film that is in what stage? Is it doing festival circuits?
Yeah, it's in festival
around so people can potentially see it on a big screen?
Yeah, we are screening around the world. We post on our Instagram of where it's screening. We're going to do a big update like this for in the next couple weeks.
Okay.
Cool. It's been doing a lot of plays in Europe, but it will come back to the United States.
Awesome. And what else is in the pipeline for you guys?
I'm in post for a feature documentary about the award-winning Brooklyn-based drag and burlesque collective Switch and Play.
Okay.
Ooh. Yeah. We have been working on this film for about 2 years now, a year and a half, 2 years, and we are in post. We're coloring, we're composing music, and then getting ready to submit to festivals and start that round, which is very exciting. And then we are, in addition to that, we are, well, our film that we were that Erica mentioned earlier that we produced, this short film, just premiered at Outfest Fusion this past weekend. So that's starting its it had its world premiere, so that's starting its festival tour.
Nice.
And then we are developing a feature. Do you want to talk about Dusty?
We're developing a feature called Dusty, which is about a fat femme pansexual burlesque dancer who is reclaiming her kind of sexual and artistic narratives in a society that fails to, you know, kind of accept who she is.
Yeah.
And she's like defining her own path and her own narrative and her own authentic voice. So we are in the long stretch of developing. It takes, you know, as anyone knows, like making an independent film takes years. Like, you know, Chelsea's talking about Switch and Play. That's taking years. And like, you know, a narrative feature, you have to raise even more money. So we're in the early stages. We're shooting a promo for it next week. And
a little mood piece.
Yeah, like a mood piece, like sizzle, proof of concept.
Cool.
And we're also working with a fabulous producer named Jackie, who is incredible, and Christina Pitter is, you know, co-creating and starring in it, and she's an amazing actor and burlesque dancer.
Is the script finished?
Yeah, we have a draft of the script, and we're workshopping the script. And basically, we're spending this year doing fellowships and grants and incubator programs, and hope to make it sometime in like 2020, 2021.
Damn. No what? Downtime for you guys. No. Ever.
And we both worked full-time jobs.
Yeah. I was going to ask. I'm very much in the spirit of financial transparency these days because it's becoming obvious that we don't talk about it. So we all always feel like shit when we're hustling and poor.
Yes.
Yeah. So
I feel like having a whole conversation about that, about everyone's hustle. I think that's a great podcast. Yeah. We work full-time jobs. I work as an art department coordinator for film and mostly TV here and around New Jersey, New York, Brooklyn area.
Cool. Do you find that feeds your work?
Financially, it feeds.
Financially,
my paycheck goes into my other projects, goes directly into Sour Peach, and rent. That's about it.
Yeah,
it's been a great thing. Our department, I've never intended to be in, but I always keep getting great opportunities. It's always been a great spot for me.
Yeah,
I'm in the 829, which is the Scenic Artists Union in New York. It's great. Such a great supportive group of people who are doing, you know, so much work that we see, and New York should keep our tax incentives.
Yes.
But yeah, so I think that it puts me in a space like I am in and around, like I'm on a call sheet and there are things of being in a production office. But at the same time, it is a very financial creative position. I describe it always as like, it's like the accounting department for the art department.
Yeah. Right.
Like I'm definitely like P cards and receipts and check requests and trucking, and it's like a lot of groundwork.
All the sexy stuff.
None of the stuff.
Creative adjacent.
Yeah. But I mean, I have like, it's been a great, it gives me an interesting perspective as a producer because I have vendors that are, you know, I know the vendors that are like construction and scenic and stage builds.
Yeah, you're
and
making all
that
those
kind of budgeting.
Yeah.
So you take what you can, I've been able to like, I work hard on like trying to get what I, and remind myself that this is beneficial, but it definitely is a drag when you're not like, in doing the thing that you specifically want to, even though I'm so close, I'm in there,
right?
But I feel like I could be back working in my restaurant job, and
totally,
I know,
be just as close.
But at least you're not stressing about wondering where that next paycheck is coming from.
100% not.
Yeah. So then, when you're not working, you can focus on your creative shit.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Erica, what's your day job?
I've been producing and production managing documentaries for the past 3 years.
Damn.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So you're in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I'm very grateful. I've done, I did a Netflix docs. I did a Netflix documentary. I just wrapped a Showtime series, and now I'm starting an HBO pilot.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So it's been pretty cool. I definitely, kind of similar to what Chelsea is saying, it's definitely beneficial in the sense that you're in this space. I've definitely, you know, in terms of just networking alone, it's been incredibly beneficial, and just meeting crew members and, you know, and making money so that we can support our personal work. And I think that what you find is that there's two types of people in the film industry. There's the type of people like us who have their own hustle going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's just the people who show up, get their paycheck, go home, go and do extracurricular activities outside of film.
Watch The Bachelor.
Yeah. So there's really two types of people. And I think especially in New York, there's so many people like us who are, you know, working these full-time jobs, but also, you know, directing a short film here and there or working on a feature. So it's, you have this incredible community around you who understands. And I've been very lucky that almost all of my work colleagues in these documentary shows, they understand. I'm like, hey, I'm also a filmmaker, and they're like, you go and do your stuff, and they let me travel to festivals and whatever, because that was them too.
Nice.
It's a grind, but you have to keep doing what you're doing because it's so necessary. The space needs to be filled. We need more of what you're doing.
Yeah,
so.
But you can only do it if it feels necessary to you. You can't fake it because it's fucking hard. Otherwise,
it's too hard.
I mean, you're talking about you're going to be trying to fundraise for a feature film, I mean, my creative partner and I are considering that too, and we're kind of weighing things because it's how much do we want to commit ourselves to maybe 5 years of trying to get that fucking thing off the ground?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, crowdfunding for Girl Talk, I was like, I don't want to do this.
Yeah.
Neither of us wanted to do it.
It is a full-time job on its own. And then so you have your compartmentalized full-time jobs. And you're like, which full-time job am I currently in the headspace for in this nanosecond?
Yeah.
But at the same time, I couldn't be doing anything else. And I, you know, am incredibly grateful that I am at this point in my life and career that I get to be here.
Yeah. And we're gaining traction. Like, people know who our work, they know who we are. We're getting like good publicity and press, and like the festival circuit knows our names. And, you know, I'm confident and cautiously optimistic.
Always.
That, like, I don't know. I think we're doing the steps it takes, and it's a long haul, but like, I agree. It's like, what else are we going to do?
Right.
Like, this is like what we like live for.
So. Yeah. Yeah. For those few moments on set.
Yeah,
there exactly. You go.
Okay, before we wrap up, would you do a quick round of our hot takes wheel with us?
Yes.
In which Alana is going to hold this wheel for one of you to spin really hard. It's going to land on a topic, and we're all going to go around and give a hot take. It is by definition a hot take, meaning don't be afraid of it not being a perfect take.
Exactly.
And completely defensible.
Exactly.
It might not be.
Chelsea, I'll let you do the honors.
All right. Here we go.
That was not hard.
It was. I was
afraid
of
it. I wish people could hear it. It's like, tick, tick,
they
tick,
can.
Tick, tick, tick.
Okay. Should I read it or spin again?
Wait, did we like what it said?
Could you date a non-creative?
Oh, yeah, I like that one.
Oh,
yeah,
that's a great one.
Do you like that
one? Yeah.
Okay, let's do that. Go ahead.
I have never.
Have you ever? So you've never even tried?
I've never even tried because I don't think I'm attracted to anyone that's a non-creative.
Mm-hmm.
Now that I'm thinking about it. Yeah, I think. Creative, and they've all been different types of creatives, with like photographers and musicians, and my current partner is the director and an editor. So yeah, but I think that ultimately I could, but I just I'm not opposed to it. I just don't think I physically or sexually could be attracted to.
Yeah, that's probably a hard pass for you then. Okay,
yeah,
Erica.
I've tried. Ugh, it was so boring.
Yeah.
I mean, like, there's nothing better to, you know, you are like on a date eating oysters and talking about creative references and thinking about each other naked. Like, you know, like, yeah, I mean, I'm still looking for my artist lady. So
whoever's listening.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I am.
Where you at?
Pretty single right now. So
all you creative types.
Yeah. All you creative types.
Slide in our DMs.
Yeah.
Please we'll hook you up.
Feel free.
There you go.
It's not a desperate plea at all.
No.
For,
she's just trying to take you guys out for some oysters.
Yeah. If anyone wants to go and grab some oysters and
Maison
talk about
premiere.
I'm not a North Brooklyn person. I like Greenpoint, but I just don't like Williamsburg, but Maison Premier.
Delicious.
But if you want to grab oysters with me in South Brooklyn and talk about references, I'm, you know, open to it. So
you heard it here.
Noted.
First.
Yeah.
I agree with you guys. I definitely could not date. I've dated across the spectrum in terms of creative and non-creative. And yes, I've been absolutely bored by those who don't understand my need to like just talk about music and the notes and the way that you're feeling and blah, blah, blah. Everyone's like, you're fucking crazy and you're like a hippie. I've always been, people say like creatives are hippies, right? And they're like, oh, you just like aren't realists, is what I've heard a lot about people who aren't creative. So I could never in a million years. I feel like your brain is programmed entirely different and you just don't see life the way that I do if you're not a creative.
Yeah.
So it's a no for me.
Okay.
Dog, in the words of Randy Jackson.
Who knows?
What about you?
I like the idea of it. I think the opposites attract and yin yang and all that stuff sounds really fun. Mm. I've kind of accidentally dated three lawyers in the last couple years, and
damn.
It's been the same experience with all of them, which is not good. I think they're very amused by me and think what I do is very like cute and weird and interesting. And so I'm like this toy that they pick up off the shelf and they look at it and they're like, this is funny. But then they don't actually want to buy it.
Yeah.
We're
also broke.
Yeah. There's a class thing that always happens with them.
Yeah.
And lawyers are very witty. So I get off on the conversation for a while, even though we're not really talking about the same things ever. Mm. But I'm like, I can make this work maybe. And then at a certain point, I'm like, yeah, you have a really bad value system. I think you only are doing your job because you make a lot of money, but you don't have any time to spend it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Bye.
No.
Yeah. So it's four no's, I think.
Yeah. I think that was an obvious.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's also good, like, on like as a side thing is like to date a creative that's not the same creative as you are is the key.
Absolutely.
Because I could not date someone else who does exactly what I do.
Oh my God.
And it's like finding that like, oh, like you're a director, I'm a producer, you're an editor, I'm a musician. Like you have, you understand the world and you, but you can also appreciate what the other person is good at without feeling like competition. Yeah.
Exactly.
Challenge.
Yes.
Exactly. Except part of, yeah. Oh, I was just saying I've dated so many actors. I you know, I love them and, you know, I think that it's, I was like, maybe I need to stop. It's like, nah. You know, but they're just so dreamy. Like, yeah. I can't help it.
I see that. I see the appeal. So going back to what we said earlier, only if you're an actor, please slide in our DMs.
Or not. Or if you were not an actor, as your friend, I'll like,
yeah,
balance you out there.
I think there actors, writers, musicians.
Yeah.
If you're a power bottom. Fine.
Pillow princess.
Definitely not a pillow princess. Maybe like a reformed pillow princess. Yeah. Then
A good switch, perhaps.
No.
Okay, it's a no. It's
too far. There's a fine line there.
Fine line.
Looked at me dead in the eyes. She was like, no.
No. But, yeah.
All right, well.
Okay, good consensus.
Here we go.
Okay, so where can people find all your stuff? Give them the plug.
Social media,
Instagram, Twitter, our email, our website. It's all sourpeachfilms @or.com. And I'm at Chelsea Allison Moore, which you can just find me from Sour Peach as well.
Yeah, and you can find me on Sour Peach, but I'm at Ear360.
Boom.
And where can you find us? At Female Gaze Pod on Instagram and Twitter. And if you guys... what am I saying? My brain just died.
We're recording later in the evening.
We are recording. It's very late. If you need to find Chelsea or Erica individually, we'll link to them in addition to Sour Peach on our social media. So that way you can click on the handle and there you'll be.
Yay. Send us more hot takes for next week, guys.
Yes,
we'll add them to the wheel. And until then.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.